Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where PGA and LPGA players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their insights and playing lessons. Join Chris every Tuesday night as he talks with the greats of the game. Tonight's show is sponsored by the PGA Tour Superstore, Ben Hogan Golf, 2-Under, TaylorMade Golf, Golf Pride, Sun Mountain Golf, Finn Scooters, and the McLemore. Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Good evening, folks, and thank you for being here. It's always a privilege for me to get to spend this time with you. Before we get started tonight, I want to give a shout out to one of our new sponsors, the McLemore, which is a beautiful community resort and golf course, just 35 minutes outside of Chattanooga, Tennessee on Lookout Mountain. And folks, you've got to see this place to believe it. Go look it up online at themclemore.com. Everything about what they have up there is beautiful. The golf course is co-designed by our good friends Bill Bergen and Reese Jones. And our friend Kip Henley on Twitter a few weeks back said outside of Pebble Beach, it's the most beautiful 18th hole he's ever seen. See why he says that by checking out the course and the resort online at themclemore.com. Tonight, folks, my first guest is going to be our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry. Folks, if you're anywhere near the highway right now, be on the lookout for a white Chevy Silverado and wave to TP as he drives by. Tom is God knows where right now. Over the next several days, he's doing a loop from Carmel, Indiana to the east end of Long Island, then back to Chicago and returning to Indiana. So like I say, be on the lookout for him. Give Tom a smile and a wave as he goes driving by. Tonight, we're going to get into TP's wheelhouse. We're going to be talking short game, short game, short game. I'll also get his thoughts on Jon Rahm's win this past Sunday. We'll talk about Jack Nicklaus completely tearing down Muirfield Village after the back-to-back tournament weeks there, and maybe a little bit about Bryson's 400-yard drives. Looking forward to catching up with TP in just a few minutes. Following him, I'll get a visit from one of the great executive producers and documentarians of all time, and that's Ross Greenberg. Ross was the president of HBO Sports for many years, has his own production company now, Ross Greenberg Productions. You've probably seen a lot of his work and a lot of the great stuff that he's done recently for Showtime and the All Access series. A lot of hockey and a lot of boxing events there. He's also done some great work for the USGA on some Jack Nicklaus documentaries, plus one about Payne Stewart and his win at the 1999 U.S. Open. We'll talk about those projects, plus a documentary he did on the 1980 U.S. hockey team, which you guys know is certainly my favorite sporting event of all time, right up there with the 86 Masters, but maybe the greatest sporting event of the 20th century. Really looking forward to getting into all of that with Ross. He'll join me about 25 minutes from now. Then we'll round out tonight's show with a return visit from TaylorMade Golf CEO David Abeles. I'm going to talk to David about the incredible run their players are on right now. You go back to DJ's win last month, and then plus Colin Morikawa winning the front end of the doubleheader at Muirfield Village, and of course Jon Rahm's win on Sunday. We'll talk about some of the equipment advances that they may have coming up next. Really looking forward to getting David back on the show. He'll join me about 45 minutes from now. So there you have it, folks. More great stories, tips, and information coming your way on tonight's edition of Next on the Tee. And as always, thank you so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me tonight. I want to start out tonight by saying hello and thank you to my friends Mitch and Matthew Lawrence, and remind you about their great golf shows. Mitch's podcast is called Talking Golf Getaways, which you can stream online at golftripx.com. It's also available on Audioboom, Stitcher, and Player.fm. Mitch and his co-host Darren Bunch are going to take you around the U.S. and Canada to some of the great places that you can go stay and play, plus let you know about some of the hidden gem courses that you might not be aware of. Again, it's available online at golftripx.com. Matthew's show is called Backspin Golf. It's my regular Sunday morning, 8:03 a.m. Eastern Tee Time. You can stream the show live by going online to WLXG.com or download the WLXG app. Features our good friend Perry French in the first segment of the show every week, so you know a lot of great tips and content coming right at you at the top of that show. Matthew has a bunch of other really great guests every week. He's a wonderful friend and a fantastic host. Again, the show is Backspin Golf, and it's on ESPN Radio, WLXG, and WLXG.com. And folks, this segment of the show is brought to you by our friends over at Finn Cycles and Golf Pride.
In golf, light grip pressure releases power. Golf Pride engineered a secret that pros know. A larger, lower hand encourages lighter pressure. Plus 4 technology is designed with 4 additional layers, which reduces tension in the lower hand to generate more power. Play Plus 4 and release the secret pros know. Now available on Tour Velvet. The winningest grip on tour. Grip confidence. Grip Golf Pride.
I also want to give a shout out to our friends over at Finn Cycles. It's time to rethink golf. The game is at a tipping point. The young people we need in the game don't have 4.5 hours to spend out on the course. Pairing Finn Cycles with a desire to play ready golf can cut playing time in half because all golfers go directly to their own golf ball. Plus, it's tons of fun. Go online to finscooters.com and click on Find a Finn for a course that has them near you. All right, now back with me is our resident director of instruction, Tom Patcher. You can visit him and improve your golf game at his new indoor facility, which looks fantastic. It's down there in Naples, Florida. Got all the gadgets, all the technology that you'll ever need. He's teaching all over the central and northern parts of the country this summer. In fact, like I said a moment ago, if you're anywhere near the highway right now in those parts of the country, keep your eyes out for that white Chevy Silverado and give Tom a wave as he passes by. If you can't flag him down, you can download the V1 video app and send him a video of your golf swing through there, or send him a question on his website, tompatry.com. You can also subscribe to his newsletter while you're on his website. Tom is also a member of the TaylorMade Leadership Advisory Board. He was a 2-time first team All-American at Florida Southern and won the Division II National Championship in 1981, was inducted into their Sports Hall of Fame in 2004. Has his own show now on Thursday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Instagram Live with them, with some really wonderful guests. His guest this week is a guy, I don't know, his name rings a bell. Can't quite place him. Maybe TP can help me out there. Hey, TP, how are you, my friend?
Chrissy boy, how you doing, pal?
Fantastic, TP. How are you?
I'm doing good, bud. I'm doing great. Hey, listen, I got a little surprise for you here. As you know, we talked earlier today. I'm on the east end of Long Island, back in my home turf. And I know you know you've followed my career for a long time, but I've got a little brief guest appearance for you tonight right here in the TP Golf Studio from Jack the Whack.
Wow.
Yeah, how's it going?
Good, Jack. How are you? God knows we've all heard so much about your golf game. Good luck to you, my friend.
I'm great. Thank you.
So Jack and I played today, Chris, and he turned after 9 holes, and he had the coach 4 shots down after I shot 1 under, and the front nine shot 3 over, and it just didn't work out at the end. The coach kind of came through in the back with a couple under here, a couple birdies, and shot 73, and Jack shot his best score ever, Chris, 74.
Wow. So good. Congratulations to you, Jack. I wish he had beaten the old man, for crying out loud. I'm looking forward to hearing that story when it happens.
Well, it's going to happen pretty soon, Chris. He's really starting to hit the ball good. He's going to just sneak up on his 15th birthday, and he's starting to really pound it out there pretty good, so it's not far away.
So, Jack, let's talk a little bit about your time with TP. What's something that TP has taught you that's made your game better?
Well, I don't even know where to start. Everything. I mean, just today, before we went out and played, he helped me with my putting so much, and I hadn't really felt comfortable over the ball in a little while. And I went out there and I had 28 putts and I felt great.
There you go. So, Jack, I mean, I think Tom talked a few months back when we were checking in on the status of your game, and you've won some tournaments. Talk about the success you've had this year.
So far this year, there hasn't been much success just because, you know, everything that's been going on. But I have had a little success late in the year. Last year, I won 2 Met PGA tournaments, which is the local junior tour, and I won my conference championship in a playoff with a senior, and I honestly don't think that I could have done it without TP.
There you go.
I only had to write a small check for that. That was not bad. That was too expensive.
No doubt. That's awesome.
We're going to let Jack sign off now. He's got to go eat his dinner and grow strong and get bigger, and then you and I can get to it here.
All right. Sounds good. Jack, take care. Best of luck.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So TP, Chris, I want to get your thoughts on some things going on around the game of golf here in the last couple of weeks. First of all, let's talk John Rahm and the win. What did you think about what you saw on Sunday?
Well, I mean, that was impressive. I mean, to play that golf course in those conditions coming down the stretch was really probably without his best game on that back nine. Just hang tough. You know, he made a couple of key up and downs in the last couple of holes, and you know, as good as he hits it, as far as he hits it, he really did some really marvelous things around and on the greens coming down the stretch. The guy is obviously a very fine player, and you know, he's had, you know, he's got 10 wins worldwide now. You know, I know we look at PGA Tour wins, but a couple Irish Opens, you know, pretty impressive in tough conditions. He obviously knows how to play in difficult conditions. I think the guy is the real deal.
So being the real deal, now he's ascended to number one in the world. He's the number one ranked player. Your thoughts on the world golf rankings?
Yeah, I don't know about the, I'm not sure about the computer. I mean, if you polled 100 guys that are really in the know as far as teachers and coaches around the country and asked them to, you know, poll their top five players, I think John would certainly be in the top five. But I don't know if I would personally rank him ahead of, for example, McIlroy or day in and day out Dustin Johnson, possibly, who I know is not in his best form right now. But I think the computer gets, you know, mathematically a little goofy sometimes. You know, I think probably more of a fan of like the coach's AP poll or, you know, the old UPI poll in college football, stuff like that. I think I'm not fond of the computer. I'd rather have, you know, some kind of, you know, maybe 100, you know, well thought of people in golf or the players voting on it week in and week out. I'm not a big fan of the computer.
So TP, I want to get your thoughts on Muirfield Village itself. Now, I know it's a golf course that you've played a couple of different times. I know Mr. Nicklaus right now is in the process of completely tearing that golf course down and going to rebuild it. But before we get into the whys around that, talk about your experience playing there.
Well, I mean, I think it's Jack's best work easily, Chris. I mean, Jack's done a lot of great golf courses, and he's, I think his architectural style has evolved over the years. Some of his early stuff I was not very fond of, but I think the stuff that he's done in the last 10 years has been really quite good. I think just like anything else, you know, you mature as a skilled architect. And I think certainly Muirfield Village is his jewel. The times I've played there, which have not been that recent, but I thought a lot of the golf course. It's a very difficult golf course, but it's a very fair golf course, and it's very big. You know, it's very big marks for me. Shot values are very high. It's a very good driving golf course. It's an excellent second shot golf course, and the putting surfaces are complex, but not unreasonable. Of course, on Sunday, it got very, very brown and crusty, and it got a little crazy, but that would happen anywhere under those conditions. The fact that he's tearing it up and redoing it, you know, speaks to who Jack is. I mean, he's always trying to make it better, tweak it. I think all great golf courses evolve. I mean, we've seen Augusta evolve, and maybe not for the best reasons in some cases, but I'm sure Jack, you know, who cares a lot about that piece of land, will do a wonderful job. I think it will probably get more difficult. I think he probably feels like it has to with the standard of play now on the PGA Tour and how far these guys are hitting it and, you know, hitting shorter clubs in some green complexes. I think he'll guard the greens better and make them a little more severe. But I'm sure he'll do a wonderful job with it.
What do you think is the impetus around it? I mean, you know, like you said, the golf course is beautiful. I mean, he's really tearing everything apart. He's redoing the greens, resurfacing the fairways, redoing some of the bunkers. Is this in reaction to the distance guys are hitting it? Do you think he's just tired of the design and wants to make a whole slew of adjustments? Why do you think he's tearing it apart?
No, I think it's definitely in response to the distance factor. I think it's definitely in response to guys hitting much shorter clubs into greens. I'm under the impression not only is he changing the green complexes as far as the contours, but I think he's also moving some greens and creating some different angles too. So I think he's trying to make it much more strategic and certainly probably, you know, addressing the distance factor. I mean, listen, I think, you know, in week one, you know, the prelude to the Memorial, they shot 19 under. And granted, it was under different conditions and maybe some different tee locations and pin locations, but I'm sure he wasn't happy with 19 under being shot on this golf course. I don't think the new design will allow that to happen again.
TP, I don't know if you got a chance to watch the tournament live or if you saw the replay, but on 16, you know, John Rahm chips in from the heavy rough just off the green. And the super slow motion replay showed that when he grounded his club during one of his practice swings, ball move. After the tournament was over, he got assessed a two-stroke penalty. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, I'm a little confused because the way the rule is written now, it mentions something to I'm paraphrasing because I don't know exactly what language, but obvious to the naked eye. You know, it had to be obvious to the naked eye that the ball moved. And clearly, super slow motion, wide-angle lens, zooming in, is not, you know, the naked eye. So, you know, I think you got to get away from... We've already gotten away from people calling in, and now we got to get away from, you know, super slow motion and zooming in on these golf balls. Because I got to believe that during the course of the week, that John Rahm was the only person who grounded his club in really deep rough and had a ball move, whether you noticed it or not. So I think when you're leading the golf tournament, you know, the eyes are on you, they're a little tighter. I think we got to go and have a conversation with TV and not create those wide or those very tight angles to get away from these controversies. I don't think John Rahm did anything intentional. I think the other part of the language of the rule is, that we have to examine very closely, is the word intent. Was there intent to improve your lie? And I don't think there was any intent there. So if there's no intent and it wasn't obvious to the naked eye, is it in fact an infraction? So I think we have to use language that protects the integrity and game, the integrity of the game, but also protects the player too. So I understand that if we saw it move, which we did, there should be in fact a penalty. But we gotta write the rule so the game is protected, but the player is also protected, I think.
And TP, with Rahm ascending to number one, he becomes only the second Spaniard to do it outside of Seve. And I know how much, you know, you revere Seve. Talk about, you know, now with Rahm being at number one and joining Seve, who meant a lot to him and obviously does to, you know, so many of the Spaniards that play the game and to the Europeans as well. Talk about Rahm being now mentioned in the same breath as Seve.
Well, I think if we go back to the computer and the relevance of the computer, and no disrespect meant to John Rahm, but John Rahm, at this juncture, maybe that'll change in the future, at this juncture, couldn't carry Seve's bag. Okay, I mean, and again, no disrespect to John Rahm, but John Rahm is not Seviano Ballesteros in any way, shape, or form. And I think he would say the same thing, quite frankly. But that being said, I think the Spanish Armada is incredible. Whether you go with Seve, or Canizares, or Alcabal, or Sergio, and John Rahm now, Jimenez, I mean, that country has produced some unbelievable golf talent, incredible golf talent. And if you look at the Spanish players, they all got it done just a little bit differently. A lot of creativity, some more mechanical, some more free, you know, freelance. That country has produced some incredible talent. And John Rahm is just the latest of that crop. Obviously a big Seve fan, but I was a big Alcabal fan also. And, it's just amazing the golf talent that's come out of that country, and John is, I'm sure, very proud of that accomplishment and being mentioned alongside Seve, for sure.
TP, with Bryson DeChambeau hitting another couple of 400-plus yard drives this past week. Now, didn't make the cut in the tournament, in the memorial part of the tournament. But you know, as we talk about, you know, Mr. Nicklaus tearing apart the golf course, but you know that watching DeChambeau hit 400-yard drives on his golf course has to be driving him nuts. And he's been saying for decades that we got to roll the golf ball back. Is that the solution, or do designers like Mr. Nicklaus got to start putting out, you know, hazards at the 320, 350-yard mark, got to start growing up the rough, got to do what they did at the Memorial to protect a golf course from guys that are now driving it that far?
So I think let's do two things, Chris. Let's first of all just make sure we understand that Bryson did not make the cut at Memorial, right? So obviously you can hit it as far as you want, but if you don't get it in play and you can't spin the golf ball, you know, it's not going to work out very well. So, you know, I think the way we protect the golf course is make sure that the driving areas at that distance, at those distances, are a little bit more penal, whether it's bunkers or whether it's rough or whether it's the actual width of the fairway. Because if, you know as well as I do, Chris, if you get down there in the inside 100-yard range and you've got a tucked pin and you can't spin the ball because you're in the rough, it doesn't do you any good. It doesn't do you any good at all. So I think you're going to see course setups become more adaptive to the driving areas being more penal. And in Jack's case, I'm sure he's going to take that into consideration with the, not only the length of the golf ball, but where the golf ball is going to land and how severe those areas are.
Tom, switching gears a little bit, let's talk some short game tips. I'm going to get in your wheelhouse with your saying short game, short game, short game. So I want to talk about from 100 yards in. So if we're at the 100-yard mark, and let's say for intents and purposes that sand wedge, if I hit a hard sand wedge, I can get it 100 yards. Is that the right play at 100 yards, or should I be taking a look at, you know, clubbing down a little bit, maybe going with a gap wedge, maybe choking down on a gap wedge, or maybe a three-quarter swing with a gap wedge for control? What should I be doing at 100 yards in if it's my sand wedge, but it's my sand wedge full on?
Well, Chris, you know how much I love you, right? I love you more than anybody else in the whole world. But as soon as you said the word hard, you lost me. Hard and short game don't go together. So if you and I were in a bar having a beer together and we decided to play the game of darts, we would throw that dart in a short, crisp stroke with a lot of precision. We wouldn't take our hand and swing it back over our left ear and throw the thing as hard as we could, because we're trying to hit a mark. So I don't ever hit any short irons. And I teach people, I call short irons just from 7 iron to gap wedge or to L wedge. I don't hit any full shots with my short irons into greens. So when I look at a putting surface, I look at it like a pie. There's a back left pin, there's a back right pin, front left pin, and a front right pin. And not only do I want to hit a short iron on a green, but I want to try to hit the short iron into the same quadrant on the green that the pin is located in, because that's how you make birdies. You got to change the proximity of your first putt. So, for example, my gap wedge full goes about 115 yards. On the golf course, that gap wedge is about a 101, 102, 103 club. Okay? I change, obviously, the length of the handle. I choke down on the club a little bit. I also change the size of my backswing and follow through. My tempo changes a little bit. And maybe, depending if I want to fight the ball down, my ball position might change. So one of the things I insist on is that when you go to a range in practice or your practice ground, that you don't hit full shots with short clubs. You practice hitting modified golf swing shots with those clubs to dial in distances that are more consistent, carry distances that are more consistent, and you change the dispersion and maybe even the trajectory of those golf shots. You practice the way you're going to play. And I don't think many people do. They go to the range and they make full swings with every club in their bag, and their scattergram out there is pretty big. Their dispersion pattern is too wide. You've got to dial those clubs in.
And Tom, since the invent of the 60-degree lob wedge, a lot of folks have fallen in love with that club, using it from, 70 yards, 60 yards, again, taking a, big swing with a lob wedge. Talk about when we should be pulling a lob wedge out of the bag and when we should not.
So again, Chris, goes back to the same explanation for me. I have a 58 degree club in my bag that is my quote unquote lob wedge. And if I did want to hit it full, I could probably hit it about 80 yards in the air. On the golf course, it's a 50-yard and in club for me. It's a precision club. It's a specialty club. I don't hit many shots up in the air with that club. I certainly don't hit it outside 50 yards. It's more of a pitching club for me. It's more of a specialty club for me. It's a bunker club for me on occasion. It's a greenside pitch and run club. It's an over the bunker pitch club. But it's very rarely a full. It's never a full swing club for me. So it's a tool that's used as a specialty instrument. And I think that people who watch golf on TV see Phil do things with an L wedge that are magical. But I think we have to keep in mind that Phil might have the greatest hands on the planet ever, besides Seve, okay, and second to Seve. And they can do things with their hands and with those clubs that the mere mortal that we are cannot do, and we shouldn't try to do. So we have to understand our limitations with that club.
TP, you mentioned a moment ago sliding the ball down, maybe moving it back in your stance. Talk about if we've got a wind or we want to flight the ball a little bit lower, how do we set up to the golf ball and how do we pull that off?
Well, that's a great question. You know, growing up as a kid on Eastern Long Island, where it gets really windy, and then playing my college golf in Florida where it was windy, I was, you know, forced to learn how to flight the ball down and hit shots on a lower trajectory a lot, especially, you know, when you played golf in the late fall on Long Island, it really blew hard and, you know, sending the ball up in the air was not an option. So I instinctively learned those things, but translating it now as a teacher, as a coach, you know, things you do is you choke down on the handle, you play the ball further back in stance, you might put a little more weight on your left side, and you might lean the shaft a little bit more forward, and then you're going to cut off your follow through and finish. You know, the great Harvey Penick said, you know, high shot, high finish, low shot, low finish, to flight the ball down. So I think the shot that I think a lot of people would benefit from if they learn how to hit those shots. Again, don't go to the golf course and learn how to hit that shot. Let's work on it on the range or in the practice ground for a long period of time until we really have command of it. And let's not try to hit it and execute it in a pressure-packed situation unless we've got a lot of reps under our belt.
Tom, just a couple more before I let you go. And I want to get right up on around the green. When we're chipping to an elevated green, should we be trying to hit the ball high and all the way back to the pin with that L wedge, with that lob wedge, or is it better to use a pitching wedge or a lower lofted wedge and let the ball bump and release back to the hole? What's your preference?
Chris, that's a great question. I think that's certainly something I see the amateur making a lot of mistakes with, but I think a lot of conditions have to be examined first before you come up with an answer. And the first thing you have to examine is the lie. Will the lie allow you to hit a lower shot? Because if the lie is poor, you need loft as your friend. And then after you've examined the lie, if the lie gives you the green light, how much green do I have to work with? And what's the condition of the green? Is it soft, is soggy, or is it firm? You know, where's the pin located? How much green do I have to work with? Is there any kind of tier on the green that I have to climb up? What are my options as far as percentage play and my skill level? So I think there's a lot of things that go into making those decisions. And I think people tend to grab one club that they call their favorite club and they play it universally. And listen, you can't fit a square peg in a round hole. So I think you need an arsenal of shots and understanding the technique and hitting different shots and make the right choice from a percentage standpoint before you go ahead and execute the shot. So, you know, you can put three balls for me side by side and put a pin 60 feet away from me. And the first thing I'm going to do is examine the lie. If there are three different lies, even though I have the same shot in front of me, I'm going to hit three different golf shots and possibly with three different golf clubs. So a lot of things go into making those decisions.
TP, before I let you go, like I mentioned in your intro, you've got a great show of your own now on Thursday nights, 8 o'clock on Instagram Live. Your guest coming up this Thursday is, the name sounds familiar, but I can't place him. Who you got coming up?
So on Thursday night, Chris, on my Instagram Live show at 8 o'clock, I've got a fella who's one of my favorites in the whole world coming on, one of the great, great personalities and great, great, you know, ambassadors in the game of golf in Chris Mascaro. He has a show called Next on the Tee, a podcast called Next on the Tee. So he's a pretty controversial fellow. The only problem I think I'm going to have with this guest coming on Thursday night is his baseball preferences, which we'll discuss, you know, that night. So if people want to tune in and hear two guys, you know, make each other bleed from their ears, it'll be a great show. I mean, I'm really looking forward to having you on. I think it's going to be really great for your listeners who really not necessarily don't know how handsome you are. They're going to get to see your face live on screen. Just make sure that you have your makeup and eyeliner on correctly and you wear your best dress. You wear your best shirt and dress on and get your hair done. We want you to look good for everybody.
No doubt. I'll have my Sunday best, my friend. All for you.
Perfect. I love you. Hey, by the way.
Yep.
You know, baseball season starts this week. I want to go on the record right now. Are we going to do a little wager on the American League East this year or not?
Oh, hey, I can't have a wager on the American League East. I got nine guys named Mo playing for the Red Sox now. I mean, no Mookie Betts, no David Price. I got nothing. I got Xander Bogaerts and eight guys named Mo.
Where is Mookie, by the way? Where did Mookie go? Oh, that's right. He's in LA now, isn't he? That's right.
He's a Dodger now. David Price is a Dodger now. Chris Sale's got the Tommy John. I got nothing.
By the way, how about that Dodger lineup right now? Is that crazy?
Yeah, they're good. Be tough to beat. But, you know, 60 games. Hell, my Pirates got a shot at winning everything when it's a 60-game sprint.
Now we're going to jump on the bandwagon of the Pirates this year? Oh, come on. Don't be
have something, TP. TP, let our listeners know how they can follow you on social media, my friend.
Obviously, Facebook, two pages, Instagram, LinkedIn, all the obvious places, Twitter. But I'm really looking forward to Thursday night and having you on at 8 o'clock. It's going to be kind of the highlight of my year, pal. They can join in on Thursday night and they'll see us, just go at it. Gloves on, baby. Let's do it.
Looking forward to it, my friend. It ought to be a lot of fun. TP, stay safe out there now. You're driving around and doing all the things you're doing. Stay safe, and I look forward to the show Thursday night.
You're the best, pal. Look forward to seeing you Thursday night, pal. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. See you, brother. That's the great Tom Patry. TomPatry.com. P-A-T-R-I. Patry. So check us out Thursday night on Instagram Live. Should be a lot of fun. TP gets to turn the tables on me. So looking forward to that, and make sure you give him a follow. All right, before I get to my next guest, Ross Greenberg, I want to give a shout out to our friends over at the Ben Hogan Golf Company. When Ben Hogan founded his company in 1953, his mission was to make the finest golf equipment in the world. And that remains their mission today. They forge every club they make to provide the feel and feedback investment clubs simply can't provide. And their craftsmen micromanufacture each club to your exacting specifications. Let me say that again, your exacting specifications, and they do it in their Fort Worth, Texas factory. You'll only find Ben Hogan Golf Equipment online at benhogangolf.com. Visit them there today to learn about their great products and their great prices. And folks, this segment of the show is sponsored by our friends at the PGA Tour Superstore.
This segment of the show is brought to you by the PGA Tour Superstore. See why golfers everywhere are proud to call PGA Tour Superstore their golf pro shop. Visit them online at pgatoursuperstore.com. Now back to Chris and more of the show.
All right, now joining me here on Next on the Tee is Ross Greenberg. Ross has been a great friend over on the football side on our show Thursday Night Tailgate for several years, and it's a privilege to have him joining me tonight on this show. Let me give you some background on him. He spent 33 years at HBO, served as vice president and executive producer of HBO Sports from 1985 to 1990, senior vice president and executive producer from 1990 to 2000, and president of HBO Sports from 2000 to 2011. Left there and started Ross Greenberg Productions and has since made some of the best sports documentaries of this or any other time for that matter. You've probably seen the All Access shows he's done for Showtime, some of the fantastic hockey and boxing events he's done there. Also did the Road to the Winter Classic and the Road to the Stanley Cup Series. He's also done a couple of my favorites, David Ortiz in the Moment, plus a few Jack Nicklaus videos for the USGA. He's won over 100 major television awards, including 56 Sports Emmys, 21 Cable Ace Awards, 12 Golden Eagle Awards, plus 5 International Monitor Awards and 8 Peabodys. And I'm very honored he's with me tonight here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Ross, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be with you. I enjoyed that other interview.
I appreciate you. So, Ross, the last time we got to spend some time together was back in January, like I say, over on the football side. Been a crazy several months since then. How are things going for you so far in 2020?
Well, pretty well. I mean, as weird as this time is, and I really reach out to everyone and just wish them the best and a healthy, happy period that we're going through. I've sold a lot because I think the bottom line is it's we're at a point in sports where, the kind of programming that I do is really important because people need a dose of sports, as we saw from The Last Dance even. And so I'm able to kind of get out in the field and lock up some new programming in a lot of different areas. So I'm actually having a good time. You know, I sold a movie to Netflix, a documentary to ESPN, a follow series with Amazon. So it's been really fun, believe it or not. You know,
no,
can't get
no
into
kidding.
Any production, but it's, you know, nice to have sold a lot.
So are there some of those things that that you've got coming up that you can sort of give us a peek under the tent about, or is that too early on
in
the process?
Yeah, I mean, I sold a movie that I've been trying to make for 15 years on the U.S. women's soccer team from 99 and their saga from really 91 to 99. Mia Hamm, Julie Foudy, Brandi Chastain, and all of them. And it's really a women's empowerment story to show that they were the first team, and they were pioneers as the first team to be taken seriously as women in American sports and really worldwide. So that's a real passion project for me, and that thing is going to be magical. We're right now looking for writers, and Netflix bought it, and you know they seem to be doing pretty well. They're a machine, so looking forward to that. And that's a feature film. That'll, you know, like I did Miracle years ago, that'll be a feature.
Yeah.
So that's an exciting project. Otherwise, you know, I'm waiting for the NHL to start up. And so I have a couple projects with them. And then, you know, onwards and upwards. So looking forward to it. Maybe I'll get some golf projects going too. I've been talking to the USGA a little bit again, and I hope to do some more golf because it's really a fun sport for me. I grew up playing it and, you know, lived on the 15th hole of Wingfoot. So
wow.
Growing up, and yeah, went back every day after school and walked my way onto the course for six holes, and no one ever bothered me. And then I do a loop. And that's really how I learned to play the game, believe it or not. I belong to a different club, but Wingfoot was like home for me, literally.
Living right there on the 15th hole, did you get to see any of the greats come through, playing through in a tournament or a practice round?
Always. I mean, actually, I started in sports because of Wingfoot, and I lived down the street from Frank Gifford, and they were covering golf back then in a big way, ABC Sports, and so Frank got myself and my best friend Kyle, his son, a job working the 1972 Women's Open and then the 1974 Massacre at Wingfoot when Hal Irwin won at 7 over par. Or was it 9 over par? It was either 7 or 9. And so that was my first entree into golf television, and then went from there and, you know, started working for ABC when I got out of school, and really centered it around golf tournaments, and then found the job at HBO in February of 78.
So are you going to be going back? Obviously, we have the U.S. Open being played there this year. Are you going to go check
it out? Yeah, well, I would, but we're not really allowed, are we? You know, I wouldn't ask for credentials because it's too hard to get, you know, in. I just no fans. They're just doing it with no fans. It's kind of sad.
Right.
Maybe if I get some work with the USGA, I can figure it out. Maybe there's a documentary there. You know,
there you go.
I mean, can you believe a major without fans? Wow.
No,
that's going to be something. That's going to be something.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to go to the Masters and Augusta National every year since 2001. And obviously, it doesn't look like that's going to happen this year. We're still waiting to hear officially, but I'm guessing that's not going to happen. And I just can't imagine a Masters, a Sunday at a Masters, right? You know, the Masters starts on the back nine on Sunday. I can't imagine no patrons at a Masters.
I mean, it's numbing when you think about Tiger, you know, a year ago, and then you think about 86 with Jack. Can you imagine if all that happened and you didn't hear those roars? I mean, it's...
Right.
You know, what a magical place that is. I had the chance to go in 2016. My good buddy, Sean McManus, I told him every year I'd say, I want to go. I think I want to go. And then finally he said, will you come in? And I said, yeah, I'll be there. And talk about a bucket list. I mean, that place, probably the best place to watch a tournament in the country, by the way. No one ever really talks about it, but, you know, it's the number one spectator golf course in America, because with all those crowds, you can still, you know, see two or three holes in standing in one position. I mean, it's the most astounding thing I've ever seen. Because growing up, I used to go to, you know, not only Wingfoot, but Westchester Country Club had a tournament every year, and I used to go there. And, you know, you had to kind of plan it out. You had to walk all over the place and try to, you know, catch up to someone. In those days, it was Arnold for me. I'd have to see Arnold. But, yeah, it really is an amazing feat they've done down there.
And what was your first impression, you know, that was the first time that you stepped foot on the property? What was that like for you?
Well, I think like everyone, you just don't realize, you know, like 18 is straight uphill. And so it's bizarre to have watched it my whole life and to see the texture and the slope of, you know, 13 and 15. And it's just a little different. First of all, the beauty of it is unparalleled. But, you know, you really are taken with the fact that the holes live are a little bit different than they are when you're sitting there watching on television. You know, the proximity between like the 15th and 16th is incredible. You know, that when I was saying you could see from one position, two holes, there's a place in a certain stands where you see that third shot, or if someone goes for it on 15, you can watch that. And at the same time, you can peek around and see what's going on the 16th green. So you really don't realize that till you're there, you know?
Right. Ross, you've mentioned the work you've done with the USGA, and you've done a handful of specials about my golfing idol, Jack Nicklaus, and you did a wonderful special about the 62 U.S. Open in a sort of a retrospective with both he and Mr. Palmer. What was it like putting that project together?
Oh, my God. I mean, talk about, you know, going to heaven. I can tell you that I've had certain days in my career that I looked forward to, and then magically they lived up to it and beyond. So, you know, we decided that one of the things we wanted to accomplish was to get Arnold and Jack to Oakmont to walk the course as much as they could, you know, at the ages of, at the time, like 72 and 82. And so we brought them both there. We had Jack's putter brought in from his museum in Columbus. And we had Arnold bring his driver and Jack bring his driver from the 62 Open. And there was a famous photo of the two of them standing there in 1962 with their, you know, woods out. And we matched that photo with them at age 72, 62. We had them walking around, but there were some really magical times there. I mean, we went to lunch, between shoots and got to all order Arnold Palmer's, including Jack, which was kind of fun, getting some laughs out of Arnold. And then, of course, we got to, you know, have them walk the course and shoot the two of them. You know, they flew in on a helicopter from La Trobe, where I guess Jack was visiting with Arnold. And, I mean, the whole place shut down. The funniest story, though, was I wanted them together on a tee. So we went to the 10th tee, and it was a beautiful spot to kind of get a shot of the two of them just peering out into the distance. And it's in the film when you see the film. But funny enough, we started shooting that shot from a couple different angles. And all of a sudden there was a women's local amateur tournament happening with really pretty good golfers. And so all of a sudden, these two women were coming off 9 and coming to 10, and they were going to tee off, and they were in a pretty heated match, obviously, and they were good golfers. So as they're coming over, I said, guys, just sit there. I don't want you moving. And, you know, we stopped shooting in deference to these two women, but I said, just sit there. I want these two women, and they probably knew Arnold and Jack were there. I just want these two women to be able to tee off right in front of the two of you, so they can tell their husbands tonight you know,
wow,
what happened when they were playing. And so, sure enough, they each get up there and hit their drives, each in front of Jack. And both, by the way, hit very nice drives down the middle. I think I would have probably popped it up or jammed it into the ground. but they just, you know, went along their way. And apparently there was a photographer there for the club. And the next day we were told the guy had taken a shot with Arnold and Jack in the background. And the woman who belonged to Oakmont had that picture sitting in her locker blown up the next day.
Wow.
Which she was able to bring home to her family. So we made a moment that day, I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
but what a thrill. You should have seen the two of them. One of the great, I'm getting chills because one of the great things was to see their love of each other and how much, you know, Jack, it's almost like Jack was treating him like an older brother, you know, and he was so respectful and he was so caring for Arnold because he was getting on in years at that point, Arnold. And Jack just wanted to take care of Arnold the whole day. I have one other funny story, if you have time, on that day,
yeah,
which was pretty fun. So if you remember the docu or the tournament, Jack had a putt on 17 that was downhill about 3.5 feet. And so he had that putter from Columbus that he had used for so many major wins. I think 14 or something of the majors was with that one putter. And so he brought that putter. And so I said, well, we want to try to recreate that downhill 4-footer, which was a pivotal moment in the match. And he had to hit it fairly hard, take the break out and sink it. So Jack, took the putt. You know, it was actually on the practice green, but we wanted to fake it. And we ended up not using it in the show, but still we shot it. And so he drilled it right in the middle of the cup. I said, well, you want to take two? He goes, why? And so I said, I guess we don't have to because you made it, you know. So at the end of that little segment, he's looking at the putter. And he's got the guy there, by the way, who brought the putter from Columbus from the museum, who had white gloves on when he handed it to, you know, Jack, because it frankly, I think it's worth $1 million, that putter. And
so
Jack says to the guy, you know, I forgot how much I love this putter. I think I might put it in the bag. So maybe maybe I'll just put it in my bag and I'll start using it. And the guy goes, Jack, you can't use the putter. Okay. That putter is worth $1 million. You can't use the putter. He goes, really? He was so upset that he couldn't start using that putter. You know, cause he did, he had this beautiful, I don't know if you remember his stroke with that putter, but he was in his prime, but my God. It was just so pure.
It
always looked like he would never miss a putt, you know, especially from, you know, 15 feet in. It just was this smooth little stroke, the way he curled his body and everything. So those were some magical moments, and I'll never forget them.
Was it difficult for Mr. Palmer to go through that? I mean, that was certainly... I mean, it was at the height of his, you know, popularity and, you know, his strength in the game.
And his hometown.
And that's a tournament he wanted to win.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I mean, and not only did he want to win it, but the, you know, 25,000 fans there, you know, that came from all over the Pittsburgh area and Latrobe area, you know, all drove in to watch their hero who was, you know, he was at the top of his game. I mean, he was, look, we all have experienced Tiger, you know, a year ago at the Masters and all those times he won. But let's not even go there. When it came to Palmer in his prime, he was, I would say, the first super, super, superstar in the sport. So he changed the whole dynamic of the game. And Tiger did too, but it had never been done to that level before. So that was his tournament, and no one was going to take it away from him. And this kid, you know, who had shown a lot of potential, because I did a docu on the 60, you know, U.S. Open, and Jack damn near won that as, you know, 19 years old or whatever the hell he was, and was playing great golf, but he hadn't won a major. He hadn't won a tournament. And so all of a sudden, you know, here he comes, and it's in the docu, but, you know, there were a lot of boos coming out. They were calling him Fat Jack. And Arnold, the same way they were the day we were with them at age 72 and 82, Arnold was very protective of Jack also for the two rounds. They played the first two rounds together because that hasn't changed. They always tried to match up the two biggest names in the first two rounds of any tournament. So they were playing together, and, you know, Jack was getting booed off the course, really, because no one wanted him to touch Arnold. And then Arnold was defending Jack, you know, and telling people to pipe down, and he was really ticked off, frankly. And they were buddies. You know, people really didn't understand. Were they competitive on the course? Yeah, but in those days, there were a lot of friendships off the course, and those two were as tight as any two in the sport. You know, they really respected the hell out of each other. So anyway, the point is Arnold really took that loss hard, except Arnold wasn't the type to, you know, to kind of look back either. And, you know, I mean, he wouldn't give you attitude. That just wasn't who he was. So as much as he hated to lose at Oakmont, he said after that final round, he said, watch out for this guy. You're seeing the beginning of something really special.
Right.
And he was right.
I think one of the things that I learned from watching that documentary that I had never seen before was on the 18th hole of the playoff, and Jack, mm-hmm. you know, wins by three, but Arnold, yeah. you know, had one sort of last gasp because Jack had about a two footer to come back. And maybe if he missed and Arnold makes this really long birdie putt, maybe it all, you know, he still has a chance. But anyway, he runs the putt. Arnold runs the putt, you know, 4 or 5 feet past, and then just sort of backhands it towards the hole. It didn't go in, and he tapped it in, and then he tried to pick up Jack. It did pick up Jack's mark as if it were match play. And Jack had to go back and still putt it. They made him go back and still putt it. That was an interesting thing.
I know. And Jack really wasn't aware of the rule either. But, you know, they told him, go back. You got to finish because you got to post a score. You can't just, you know, this isn't match play. So Jack went back. I mean, it's kind of odd because I wonder if he placed the ball exactly where he was supposed to. But he, you know, he was so far ahead at that point, it really didn't have any bearing on the match or tournament. So he went off and won it. It was a kind of a weird way to finish, you know, that playoff. And playoffs are weird anyway in a lot of ways. There's something about the tension of a Sunday, you know, versus a playoff anyway. So I'm sure they would have rather seen it end on Sunday. Arnold had a really good shot of winning it on Sunday, remember?
Yeah. They both had a birdie putt on the 18th hole.
Mm-hmm.
They could have won it from not all that far out, and neither one of them was able to knock it down. But yeah.
I know.
Ross, one more before I let you go. And you did a documentary and a feature film that you mentioned at the top, Miracle, about the 1980 U.S. hockey team. You did the docu, Do You Believe in Miracles? And like I say, with that feature film. And to me, that's the you know, for my generation, I think the most important sporting event of the 20th century. What was it like for you putting together both of those?
Well, that was a labor of love, because that story really did something to me. And in 2000, you know, I felt that no one had ever really told the entire story. It wasn't just a hockey game. There was something bigger going on in the late 70s in the United States. And, you know, that team grabbed everyone's attention for a reason. And as many upsets that I had seen at that point in my life, including, you know, being the producer of Tyson Douglas, I had never experienced that kind of upset. And we will never see that kind of upset again because, you know, these were a bunch of U.S. college kids going up against probably the best, quote, professional team hockey players in the world. You know, they had beaten many teams from the NHL. They had beaten all-star teams from the NHL. They had not lost in many, many years, including four Olympics in a row, I believe. And there was no way, you know, that the United States was supposed to win that. And I knew of the stories of Herb Brooks, and I matched it up with, you know, all of the lines for gas and the difficult times that Carter was having and the United States going through this, you know, the hostage crisis and this feeling of inferiority. And the mood of the country was so negative and the Cold War with Russia was at its height. And that team just for that brief couple of weeks in Lake Placid turned it all around. And so that story just stuck with me. And so after doing the docu, I felt like we had the script in front of us. You know, the story was just laid out in the docu. So while I was making the docu, I got Herb Brooks to sign a contract, cause I knew it was a feature and he was great about it. And I got his rights. And then I was really in a meeting, you know, with a guy from Disney and, he asked me what I was doing. And I explained that I was in the middle of a documentary on the 80 hockey team and he almost fell off the chair. And he said, well, I've always wanted to make that film. And I said, well, let's go make it. I got Herb Brooks is right. So he said, in 30 seconds, I sold that film to Disney. Wow. And then went on the magical ride, you know, Herb passes away like 2 weeks before principal photography starts, but you know, we assembled this great crew and staff and a great group of actors. And then, of course, you know, Kurt Russell just, that part and that role, that execution of a role was as good as anyone I've ever seen in a movie, frankly. And it was just a magical, you know, Gavin O'Connor, great director, just nailed it. And it was his first big film. And Disney was great. You know, they got behind it and bang, it hit big, you know?
Yeah.
And you know what's fun about that movie? It's still, you know, a lot of teams and a lot of sports get together the night before a big game and watch that movie for motivation. So I get a kick out of it. It's become a cult classic, you know? When sports movies are classics, they're put on another level, really. And you know, when Hoosiers is on, I'll sit there and watch the last 30 minutes over and over again, or remember the Titans or, you know, Rocky or, you know what I mean? There's something special about the great sports movies. I hear it enough from enough people to know that Miracle is now in that category. And that's, you know, a lot of pride in that.
And it, as you know,
it's really a tribute to the people who put it together.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, one of my prized possessions for two reasons is a poster from the movie that Jim Craig signed for me because we had the privilege of having Jim on the show not all that long ago. But I got it because, first of all, because it's a Ross Greenberg production. And then Jim was good enough to sign it for me. So I have it hanging in my office. So that's one of my prized possessions.
Oh, wow. I have the poster hanging in my workout room here. Yeah. And one in the office, I think. They gave me a bunch of posters. I didn't get many DVDs, though. and I don't get any checks.
That's the worst part. My goodness.
I know. I don't know what happened there, but.
Well, Ross, before I let you go, let our listeners know, how can they stay up to date with all the great things that you're doing and the projects that you have coming up?
Well, I know I'm on Facebook and Twitter, but I don't hit that Twitter account very often, and I'm on LinkedIn and everything else. So I'm around, and I have a website, RossGreenbergProductions.com. So take a look and stay with me. I'll have plenty to talk about in the future.
Well, Ross, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come,
Chris,
and be a part of this show. And I hopefully we get to catch up with you again soon.
You will. Thanks, Chris, a lot.
Thank you, Ross. Take care. Stay safe. All the best to you and your family.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
That's a great Ross Greenberg. Folks, go out and check out his website, RossGreenberg.com. I mean, the stuff that he has been a part of is absolutely astounding. And from a golf perspective, four specials for the USGA, three of them about Mr. Nicklaus, one about the 1999 U.S. Open that Payne Stewart won, and then so many great all-access and feature films. And very generous with his time, a wonderful guy, and I really look forward to catching up with him again real soon.
All right, before I get to my next guest, I want to give another shout-out to our new sponsor, the McLemore. The McLemore Mountaintop Community rests atop the highlands of Lookout Mountain, Georgia, overlooking historic McLemore Cove and Pigeon Mountain. Surrounded on all sides by state and national parks, historic land districts, and private land trusts, the resort features an 18-hole Reese Jones and Bill Bergen championship course, a gated residential community, and a planned clubhouse opening in the fall of 2020, plus planned hotel and conference center. The dramatic 18-hole course is made up of a variety of golf experiences, combining canyon holes, highland holes, cliff edge holes, that are well-suited for the beginning golfer as well as the senior player. McLemore also offers a wonderful 6-hole short course called the Karen. Designed by Bill Bergen, the Karen provides players with a short warm-up or cool-down before or after a round, or a relaxing way to improve one's game with family and friends. McLemore is located a short driving distance from Atlanta, Nashville, Knoxville, Birmingham, and Huntsville, and just 35 minutes from downtown Chattanooga, voted number one best town in America 2 years in a row by Outside Magazine. While a private course, McLemore offers stay-and-play packages for guests in club-managed properties, as well as a number of membership opportunities, including social memberships, non-resident memberships, and corporate memberships as well. For more information, please visit McLemore online at themclemore.com or give them a call at 800-329-8154. And folks, this segment of the show is sponsored by our friends over at TaylorMade Golf and their TaylorMade TP5 and TP5X golf balls. Played by Ricky Fowler, John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson, and Jason Day. It's the hottest tour ball in golf. You know those names, but thousands of other golfers have already made the switch to TP5 and TP5X. And now they're available in high visibility yellow. And you guys know how much I love the yellow golf ball. Are you next to make the switch? Check it out at TaylorMadeGolf.com for more information. All right, now back in making his seventh appearance with me here on Next on the Tee is David Abelese. He is the president and CEO of TaylorMade Golf. If you look back at David's career, he joined TaylorMade as their general manager for their Asia Pacific division, later moved over to be the director of sales for North America, left TaylorMade for a bit to go over to Titleist and the Acushnet Company to become their vice president of sales and marketing. He came back to TaylorMade as their executive vice president and general manager, took over as CEO in February of 2015. He and they have been knocking it out of the park ever since. And I'm very thrilled he's back with me again tonight here on Next on the Tee. Good evening, David. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Good evening, Chris. Thanks for having me back. Gosh, I feel so dated that you said it's our seventh time together. And then that lead in with the resume. Gosh, you're making me feel a lot older than I am.
No doubt. I'm sure that, you started out when you were about 15 years old. So you still got a lot of mileage to go. No question.
Well, thanks.
David, I want to talk about the run that the brand has been on lately. I mean, John Rahm's win on Sunday at the Memorial, which followed the win by Colin Morikawa at the Workday Charity Classic, obviously there at Muirfield Village as well. Joel Stalter, over on the European Tour. You go back a few weeks, did DJ's win at the Travelers Championship. You go all the way back to May about the great event that you guys put on, the TaylorMade Driving Relief event. Boy, you guys are on a heck of a run.
Yeah, Chris, it's been a tremendous resurgence of golf, honestly, at every level, not just the tour. Obviously, the tour is so visible. It's such a big component of the golf community, and Obviously, it's our major sports league. And really, obviously, the energy starts on tour, and then it manifests itself down to players of all skill levels in different areas around the world. It's been amazing. You know, it did start the first live golf event broadcast by NBC Sports, produced by TaylorMade and the PGA Tour, was the TaylorMade Driving Relief event, as you mentioned, at Seminole Golf Club, of all places, down in South Florida. It was really, really special for us to be part of something, not just to raise money for COVID relief and the associated beneficiaries and charities, but it was very, very cool to bring live golf back to a world that really was hungry to see professional golf at the highest level again. So to see Rory and Dustin and Matt and Ricky play together and really get the season restarted was kind of the genesis of everything that kind of happened afterwards. And then, you know, Jay Monahan and his team at the PGA Tour got protocols in place, the COVID-19 safety testing in place, and they're off and running. And we have we've been on a tear. You know, we had a saying, sadly, when things started to become more of a pandemic than an epidemic, and we started to see some of the Western markets around the world be impaired by COVID-19 and things start to slow down a bit, which has been challenging for everybody, not just golf. We said as an organization, we're going to do some things over this period of time that aren't simply about selling world-class golf equipment and golf ball. We're going to do things to help the world the best we can, to contribute the best that we can, and bringing live golf back was one of those things. And we wanted to kind of migrate through this pandemic and be a better company because of it. And here we are in the middle of July. And as you mentioned, between Dustin's win a few weeks ago and our young superstar and Colin Morikawa winning at Muirfield the first week, and then subsequently John Rahm ascending to number one in the world, replacing another TaylorMade staffer, Rory McIlroy, as number one player in the world, winning Memorial at Jack's Place. It's just been very, very special. We're humbled by it. As you know, and your listeners know, we have a wonderful group of staff professionals, including Tiger, that's starting to make his way back now after quite a bit of a layoff, that represent our brand. And we celebrate like I think the world celebrates when they win. So it's been a tremendous run for the last few weeks, and really has helped fuel the momentum of our people, the game of golf, and everybody involved.
David, I don't want to gloss over the TaylorMade Driving Relief event that you did, because I want to spend just another moment on it for two reasons. One, you guys gave us a glimpse of Seminole Golf Club, a place that we've heard about but never seen. So we got an opportunity to see the golf course for the very first time. And then I believe you guys raised about $5.5 million with that event. Talk a little bit about both of those things.
Yeah, but both are true. So Seminole Golf Club is one of the really great golf facilities, not just in North America, but globally. It's a very, very, very special facility. My good friend Bob Ford is the general manager there. And if it weren't for the president of the club, Jimmy Dunn, for giving us access to Seminole, it wouldn't have been held there. And we all aligned initially around the simple notion of how cool would it be to bring four great tour players together and create some content to keep things light during a pretty challenging time as we really entered and started to migrate through the coronavirus situation. And so what started as, let's get four great tour players together, create some content, push that content, have some fun with it, really developed into a bigger idea, which is how can we take four superstar tour players, local residents of South Florida, so they can drive to the golf course and be safe and exercise the safety protocol, work with the PGA Tour, get a broadcast partner, none better than NBC, to step on in and help produce this. And here we go. So the idea became something a little bit larger, and then we got started. But make no mistake, really what was in the center of all of the thinking always was, how can we contribute back? You know, unfortunately, our manufacturing capabilities don't enable us to make masks or PPE. We try to raise as much money for a lot of different charities as we can. That's the type of company we are. But this was a moment in time. It's been obviously an extraordinary and unprecedented past several months. We said, hey, why don't we use the leverage of our brand, the strength of our position in golf, the access to these incredible tour players, the relationship with Bob and Jimmy at Seminole, the plug in with NBC and produce something really special. And you're right. In the end, we raised actually just under $6 million, Chris. So $6 million, for the CDC Foundation, the American Nurses Foundation, those that are on the front lines fighting this pandemic every day, that are the real heroes. So it was very, very special. What was a simple notion and simple concept at its origination, became something much bigger and actually much more impactful, we believe.
David, a moment ago, you mentioned the word energy. And when you look at guys like John Rahm and Morikawa and Matt Wolf, three tremendously talented young players, all under the age of 25 years old, right? Now with Rahm being the number one player in the world, these guys seem to me like they could energize the sport. I felt for years now that the PGA Tour has sort of put all of its eggs in the Tiger Woods basket. And I don't think they have to do that anymore with these great young players. I think the game of golf is in great hands, and I think people will get energized by these young guys. Kind of wanted to get your thoughts about these three guys and what they can do to energize the sport and also energize younger players to get involved.
Yeah, Chris, it's an interesting dichotomy between athletes that are later on in their careers and athletes that are at the beginning of their careers. And for me, and certainly what we've seen through the lens of TaylorMade and through the game of golf, is the best situation is when you have multiple generations of golfers, whether certainly we're talking about the tour right now, that come together and really create a different complexion of the tour. So make no mistake, when Tiger Woods tees it up, even to this day at 44 years old and the greatest player in my mind of all time, the world of golf stops and takes notice, and Tiger does what Tiger does. He plays the game's highest level. He wins major championships. He's had the greatest comeback, again, my opinion, in the history of sport. And then you compound his energy and how he moves the sport and the game of golf forward with these young superstars that are 25 years and younger that aspire to play at the level that Tiger played at the prime of his career. And I'd argue he's still in the prime of his career. It wouldn't surprise me at all if Tiger doesn't win several more major championships. He's playing the game of golf differently than he did maybe 10 years ago. But he's still there, and he's still creating energy. And then you have this young group of athletes, many of them that we acknowledge are TaylorMade athletes, but there's other athletes as well. Justin Thomas is one of them. Watching Bryson DeChambeau kind of redefine the way golf is played is interesting in itself. So there's this wonderful group of young athletes that are hungry to build their careers, to establish their own precedent, their own position in the game of golf. And they're aggressive, and they're tenacious, and they're competitive. And you know what? They're all great human beings, too. And so if you were to ask me the simple question of how is the game of golf positioned today relative to when Tiger really was the epicenter of everything, I would say the game of golf, as a byproduct of having Tiger playing the way he does in this comeback and these young athletes coming up, is better positioned today than ever. And that's what excites me. And we're starting to see that. We're seeing audiences of all generations and all nationalities across ethnicities and genders come and watch the game of golf right now. And honestly, Chris, that's what's most exciting. When the game is healthy, when participation is on the rise, when the game at the highest level, the best players in the world are playing their very best, which they are, it's just exciting. And we're fortunate to all be experiencing that again right now.
David, I want to get your thoughts on something that stuck out to me and I feel like is sort of a shame on us in the media. But when I watched the tournament on Sunday, John's spectacular performance on a very difficult golf course, he comes off the 18th hole after having just won by, at that point in time, 5 strokes. And we know about the penalty strokes that got assessed later. But that's what they wanted to talk about. They wanted to let John know that, hey, this ball might have moved and we might have to assess, they might assess you a 2-stroke penalty. And it felt like to me that was sort of the negative media. I mean, we wanted to suck the joy out of John Rahm's performance and winning by whether it was 5 strokes or 3 strokes. To me, that wasn't the story. The story was how beautiful he played. It was the greatness of the chip shot, regardless if the ball moved a dimple or not, which I'm sure he didn't see. And, if it wasn't for, cameras that could zoom in super slow-mo and anything, nobody else would have seen. And it certainly didn't make a difference in the lie he had, but that's what they wanted to talk about. And I don't know, your thoughts, are we focused on the wrong things too often to try to accentuate the negative instead of the positive?
Well, I think the obligation of the media at every level is to report facts and to create energy and excitement around the content that they're reporting on or announcing. And that enables all of us to kind of migrate to a better place and appreciate the things that we're trying to build together. So in this case, the game of golf, the development of golf, and certainly the entertainment value on the tour. I watched, you know, every minute of that broadcast. John and I are extremely close, as you could probably imagine. I know John, and John sold. He had no idea the ball moved. No idea. In fact, most of us as golfers, put yourself in John's shoes. You go through a pre-shot routine. Half the time, you know, you're looking at the flagstick, you're looking at the hole, you're visualizing the shot, you're getting into the shot. John was utterly shocked, as you know, when they asked that, because John is the most truthful, honest human being I've ever met. He is as genuine and as authentic as everything you saw in that post-round interview. And I'm so proud of him, not only for winning the event the way he did, but handling his business and handling that interview in a manner that is consistent with his professionalism and his dignity and his authenticity to the game of golf. So do I think the media at times tries to polarize situations, both positive and negative? Yes. But I guess that's kind of the nature of reporting, right? You're trying to create a dialogue. You're trying to create some type of position that will ultimately create a larger audience. Do I think that that was appropriate in this case? No, I don't, personally. Do I think it was in the best interest of golf? No. Do I think there could have been more time dedicated to celebrating the fact that John won that golf tournament, even with the penalty by 3 shots, without the penalty by 5 shots, and, you know, by John's own admission, played the best golf of his life, ascended to world number one with the pressure of a nation, Spain, on his shoulders to become the second Spaniard to become world number one behind Seve Ballesteros. I mean, how that storyline in John's personal storyline gets overshadowed by something like that, I think is unfortunate, because John's story, if you really dig into, you know, how John got into the game of golf, his family values, who inspired him, how he ended up at Arizona State, when he turned professional after school, how he's ascended to world number one, to me, that's a heck of a lot more interesting than the potential of a dimple rotation or oscillation on a golf ball that, quite frankly, really wasn't the lead story. So I'm disappointed it ended up the way that it did. But I'll tell you what I'm not disappointed in, Chris. I'm not disappointed at all in John Rahm. In fact, I'm unbelievably proud of him, and I think people should celebrate. And I know we all are, because I watched the media the next day, and everybody responded to the greatness of John Rahm ascending to world number one. So, yeah, you know, I think there's adjustments. Modern media, whether it's in politics and golf and sport, it seems to be a bit out of balance right now. And my hope is that, you know, the great reporters that report the facts as they are, take the high road and motions and scenarios that they should return back. And I think that would be a better scenario for not just the sport, but for our country and for all of us as human beings.
Yeah, couldn't have said it better any way, shape or form. To me, all of the things you just mentioned were the story. That ball oscillating was not, and I'm disappointed that it became it, at least for right after the event. But speaking of that incredible chip shot that John made on 16, we all want that wedge now, David. Talk about what he used and the recent wedge innovations you guys have put together that made that shot possible on top of his talent.
Yeah, so that was a 60-degree milled grind 2 wedge from TaylorMade. The first mass production commercialized raw face wedge that you can buy at retail right now. So if you go into your local golf shop and you look for a milled grind 2 wedge from TaylorMade, what you'll see is a sticker on the face of the wedge that you peel off. And then that wedge face is actually raw. It's not chromed. It's not PVD finished. So it gives you additional spin rate. In fact, in wet conditions, it gives you up to 300 to 500 more RPM a spin. And in dry normal conditions, it gives you 200 to 300 more RPM with better control. John fell in love with the wedge. Our entire staff, Tiger plays the wedge. Rory plays the wedge. Dustin plays the wedge. Colin plays the wedge. And then there's a series of players that are outside of our stable. Jason Day, actually part of TaylorMade. He's a great wedge player, plays the wedge. But all of those athletes, amongst many others, play the wedge. It's one of the hotter products in the market right now because it's a real innovation. It's not just about shape, not just about groove symmetry. It's about a face dynamic that is very different than what's been done in golf before. And fortunately, it's become a very popular product. And John hit, you know, a magical shot with it. And I can promise you this and your audience that we'll run that over and over again and try to talk about the technology that enabled him to do that. But make no mistake, the technology was great. The talent was equally as good.
And David, I have to tell you, you know, I thought your first generation of Spider putters were the best putters that I've ever used. But the new Spider X putters somehow are even better. Talk about why that is.
Yeah. Well, you know, putters are so personal. Shape, sizes, inserts, feel. But what I like about Spider X is that we were able to do a couple of things with this product. The first thing, Chris, is get the inertia properties up even higher, which means the stability of the putter is even better. So on off-center hits, believe it or not, we all hit off-center putts from time to time. The ball will stay on line and the face will not rotate and the head will not oscillate. So that's a very good thing from a technical standpoint. The face is more stable. The head is more stable. The other thing we did is create what's called true path alignment on the top. So you can see a white line on John's putter. He plays the chalk version. Rory plays the copper version. Dustin plays the navy blue version. And on the top of that putter, there's a white line, a thick white line that is essentially designed in such a way that enables you to align your putter to the golf ball and to the hole or to your sight line. And so the optical engineering of the putter has enabled us to create a better visual and a better alignment aid to build a better putter. And then we use a pure roll urethane face insert, which is very soft, grips great roll, and the ball starts rolling off the face. So I don't know if you know this, Chris, but Spider has won more PGA Tour events over the past 4 years than any other putter brand combined. The Spider model itself. It has been the hottest mallet in golf. It continues to be the hottest mallet in golf, and we're proud of it. It's become a bit iconic, and it's a special product, and we'll continue to work to make it better every year that we think about bringing the next one to market. So it was really nice to see John putt so well, and certainly Rory got it rolling this week, had a difficult time on Sunday. It was a tough golf course out there, but it wouldn't surprise me if Rory comes back and wins the World Golf Championship in a couple weeks in St. Jude. So Spider is in the bag of most of our tour players, and they're winning with it.
David, just a couple more before I let you go. And you know, with the pandemic, you know, more players that I know are choosing to walk and carry their own golf bags. And you guys have a new FlexTech Lite Stand bag that's out there on the market. Talk about what you guys are doing to make golf bags easier to use and lighter to carry.
Yeah, I mean, the simple notion of comfort and lightweight and stability, right? So those three variables, if you put them together and start to really engineer a golf bag around those variables, is it comfortable to carry? Is it lightweight? Is it functional? You got something pretty good. So yeah, we launched a product called FlexTech Lite. It's a wonderful golf bag. It's the bag that we go back to the COVID-19 relief, the TaylorMade Driving Relief event, that all of our staff players were carrying as they carried their bags, much like we did when we were kids growing up, Chris, right? Around the golf course. So yeah, it's a wonderful stand bag product. It's got a wonderful design, good look to it. Extremely functional, very lightweight. And, you know, one of the things I'm most thrilled about right now, and sadly we needed this pandemic to perhaps supercharge golf and drive participation, is we're seeing a tremendous resurgence in golf, and we're seeing a tremendous resurgence of golf in those players that want to carry recreationally. And so that product is working very, very well for us, very well for golfers that are either in the game in that carry or coming to the game that want to carry. It's functional, it's lightweight. Well designed, and I think if your audience hasn't tried it or if you're in the market for a sandbag, give it a shot. Take a look at it. I think you'll like it a lot.
David, before I let you go, give us a glimpse into the future. What are some things that we can look forward to the TaylorMade brand coming out with, whether it's the rest of 2020 or maybe something we can anticipate looking ahead to 21?
Yeah, well, you may have seen some of the social leaks on some of the P-Series irons that we're launching this fall. And my marketing team would put me in a tough place if I gave you too much detail. But as you're well aware, the P790, which is the first foam-filled forged distance iron in market, has become an iconic product in golf. It's been the number one selling performance distance iron in golf for the better part of the last 4 years now. Well, it's going to have a brother coming soon that's a little bit more traditional in shape and size. You may have seen socially that We launched the P7MB, which is Rory's muscle back. He came out of the old P730 and now is into the P7MB, and then we'll have a muscle cavity version of that this fall as well. So we've got three beautiful new forgings coming this fall that will round out the, you know, the player's performance product segment of our product line, and they are absolutely sensational. So excited for the world of golf to see and experience those. And then, as always, you know, Arpany is wholly dedicated to technologies that help golfers of all skill levels play better. So as we work into 2021 and beyond, we fully anticipate bringing even better products than what we have today. And as you know, the Sim Metal with an Irons products have taken the world of golf by storm. I'm just so exceptionally proud right now of our R&D teams and product creation teams. We're bringing products to golfers across a spectrum of skill levels that are helping golfers play better. And that gives us a lot of energy and excitement moving forward. So more to come from TaylorMade with better technology and better performance.
David, let our listeners know how they can follow up with all those great things and find you guys online and on social media.
Yep, anytime. TaylorMadeGolf.com. You can view us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, on our TaylorMade Golf handle, and love to see the content, not just the products, the content of our athletes, them talking about the products and their most recent wins. And wouldn't surprise me if you see a little content from World Number One coming out pretty soon.
No doubt. David, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come back and be a part of the show for a seventh time. I always enjoy getting to spend time with you.
Likewise, Chris. And thank you very much for everything you're doing it, and more importantly, doing it the right way. You do a terrific job. Thank you.
I appreciate you, David. Take care. Stay safe. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
That's the great David Abele, CEO of TaylorMade Golf. And folks, the stuff is fantastic. I mean, I'm telling you sincerely, the Spider Putter, I have the original model of the Spider Putter, and I love the Spider Putter, and it certainly made me a better putter. And when they came out with the Spider X, they sent me one of those, and it's even better. I can't believe it's better, but it is. I enjoy putting with that immensely. It's a wonderful club, and it's helped me even make more and more putts. And the Sim Irons, love the Sim Irons, folks. If you haven't had an opportunity to go swing them at a PGA Tour superstore near you, please go in there into the bay, grab yourself a Sim Iron or try the new, the Sim Woods. Fantastic. With the twist face technology, brings the ball back to center. I'm telling you, you're going to love them. All right, folks, it is time for me to put a bow on this episode of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks go out to Tom Patrick, Ross Greenberg, and David Abele for joining me. Please check out our website, nextonthetee.net, to stay up to date with what our guest schedule looks like. You can stream the show on so many great podcasting sites. Can't thank the folks enough over at podcast.co, and that's .co. They've been a huge help. Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, AudioBoom, Player.fm, and really want to welcome the new folks that have picked up the show, radio.com. Thank you for putting us as a part of your platform as well. And folks, the biggest thanks go out to you guys for choosing to listen to this show every week. Really appreciate you and the fact that you continue to make us a part of your golfing content. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends.